Mark Clegg tells us, with a keen ear for the sounds and slang of roaring 20s New York City, the Gershwin brothers sparked a revolution in American music that risked aesthetic heresy. Their art crossed boundaries of black and white, popular and classical. They brought the energy and humor of the Yiddish theater to Broadway. They put slang in poetry and jazz instruments onto the stage of Carnegie Hall. George, as composer, and Ira, as lyricist, worked quickly, often sitting side by side at the piano with a tireless improvisational energy that was tragically interrupted. George's sudden death on July 11, 1927, from a brain tumor, stunned the musical world. Ira stopped writing lyrics. The fabric of the Gershwin family was torn. Music had lost a powerful, creative voice. The composer's death also left much undone. I only wonder at the imagined sound of George Gershwin's First Symphony, or of the opera he might have composed as a follow-up to Porgy and Bess. Also undone was the editorial curation of the composer's legacy. If, like Aaron Copland, George Gershwin had lived to be 90 years old, I would not have been appointed as editor of the George and Ira Gershwin Critical Edition. Instead, the composer himself would have clarified questions like what pitches the taxi horns are supposed to sound in American in Paris, or how many first versus second violins are called for in the orchestra of Porgy and Bess. What began with an email from Todd Gershwin, great-nephew of George and Ira, has since become a reality. Announced in the fall of 2013, the George and Ira Gershwin Critical Edition is a unique agreement between the Gershwin families, the University of Michigan, and Schott Music International. The goal of the project is to create new authoritative editions of all of George and Ira Gershwin's creative works, including orchestral compositions, opera and musical theater, chamber and solo works, independent songs, and film scores. The initial editions include the 1924 jazz band version of Rhapsody in Blue, featuring some 40 bars of piano solo recovered from sketches, the 1928 orchestral tone poem An American in Paris, and an all-new edition of Porgy and Bess. As an example, the critical edition of An American in Paris offers insight into our editorial work. The new score is rooted in a clean transcription of George Gershwin's handwritten full score, now held in the Library of Congress. This archival treasure contains an original ink layer, plus several layers of revisions and changes made in ink, pencil, and colored pencil. All but a handful of these revisions were made before or shortly after the New York Philharmonic's December 1928 world premiere, and are confirmed by a February 1929 recording supervised by the composer. Fortunately, Gershwin's own painterly handwriting is clearly identifiable throughout the score. In part, our task in editing An American in Paris is to remove corrections and adjustments made to the score to make George Gershwin's musical voice more palatable to mid-century ensembles and listeners. These changes made Gershwin's music a bit less modernist, less jazz-inflected, and more classical. The saxophone parts of An American in Paris, for example, were simplified in the 1940s to eliminate doubling and tripling fees for the musicians. Another remarkable finding concerns the iconic taxi horns of An American in Paris. It turns out that for the past 70 years, the pitches used are not what Gershwin intended. George famously selected four taxi horns for use in the piece from more than 20 he purchased in Paris. Diaries and interviews confirm that George was searching for horns that sounded specific pitches, and thus that these acoustic souvenirs are more than just sound effects. They are melodic and harmonic components of his musical argument. Nevertheless, the composer's score notates the taxi horns in the percussion parts on a single line staff in a manner typical of a snare drum, triangle, or other unpitched percussion. Gershwin then marks each taxi horn motto with a letter, A, B, C, or D, to indicate which taxi horn should sound. Since at least the 1940s and performances by the NBC Symphony and New York Philharmonic, conducted by Arturo Toscanini and Arthur Roginski, these letters have been interpreted as pitch names. However, the 1929 recording, combined with a recently uncovered photograph, reveal that these alphabet notations are merely labels for the four taxi horns, and that the original sounding pitches of the horns Gershwin had selected were A-flat and B-flat, a high D and a low A. The new score also corrects a small number of note errors, and most importantly, restores and clarifies Gershwin's markings for dynamics, articulations, and bowings. I expect that musicians will make this score their own through interpretation in performance, but the new pristine edition will result in less wasted rehearsal time and more compelling and convincing performances. Works of Mark Clegg of the University of Michigan in Senza Sordino in March 2016. We've just heard that Todd Gershwin was instrumental in having the vision and informing the partnership for the George and Ira Gershwin Critical Edition. Not only does Todd care about the project that will present the works and music of the Gershwin brothers in the clearest, most authoritative manner possible, as we learn from Dr. Clegg, for the benefit of professional musicians everywhere, but Todd Gershwin cares passionately about getting the music of George and Ira Gershwin out to listeners all around the world. And it's part of the reason he is so excited by a multimedia program titled Rhapsody and Rhythm, the Gershwin Concert Experience, that will kick off the Misericordia Under the Stars Summer Arts Festival Monday, August 8th on the Misericordia campus in Dallas, just outside Wilkes-Barre. Classically trained pianist Richard Glaser and headline singer and band leader Michael Andrew will perform some of the most popular Gershwin songs. I Got Rhythm, It's Wonderful, They Can't Take That Away From Me, Summertime, and of course Rhapsody in Blue. In addition to the legendary music, the concert includes rare Gershwin home videos, photos, special family stories, and more. In anticipation of the August 8th Gershwin Experience at Misericordia, we had a chance to speak by phone with Todd Gershwin of the Gershwin Family Foundation about the program and the Gershwin family.
George and Ira Gershwin were my great uncles, and they had a third brother, Arthur Gershwin, who was my grandfather. And Arthur had one child, Mark George Gershwin, who's my father. And he had me, so it's actually a pretty straightforward lineage in terms of George and Ira being my great uncles. And fortunately, my family has the honor and the privilege of owning and managing George's business and copyrights, which allows us to do our part to continue his legacy and allow people to experience his music all around the world.
Could you tell us about Grandpa Arthur? He was musical too, wasn't he?
He was. He also was a composer, not quite as iconic as his two older brothers, but he loved music, and he picked it up from, you know, being their younger brother and composed, and then as it eventually he got more focused on the business side of the music industry with George's business after George passed away way too young, and that, you know, forced my grandfather to really learn the business. And I think he made a decision that he gave up really his music career so he could help, you know, share George's music after George passed away with as many people as possible.
And how about growing up in your household? Was it a musical household? Did you hear a lot of music when you were a lad?
Yeah, it was a very musical household in that we heard tons of music, and I was very fortunate to be exposed at a young age to going to the theater, to concerts, the symphony hall, the opera. So I was very fortunate that I was exposed to lots of music, lots of Gershwin music, and it's great. You know, I love it, and I loved being exposed to it. I have two daughters now who I try to get to listen to both Gershwin and anything else they'll listen to, and they love it. So it's really fun to be able to pass down the music and the legacy from generation to generation.
And if we pay attention to what's out there on the internet, we know that you're a sports lover, though, right?
Correct. I think, you know, music, and you know, they say that every musician wants to be an athlete, and every athlete wants to be a musician, and you know, they're so similar in terms of the live experience, whether it's sports or whether it's music, and I have a passion for both, and I love just being part of being able to put on a show, whether it's a game, a concert, a Broadway musical, and just, you know, let people escape and enjoy themselves for a few hours.
You alluded to the organization that is in place now and that the family has the ability to make this music available to us. It was a great headline in the news in March just recently about the taxi horns in An American in Paris, learning about the key and what was discovered. And that was part of a larger project that you all are undertaking to make sure that we get the critical edition. Can you remind some of our listeners about those taxi horns?
Yeah, no, it's a wonderful project. So we've partnered with the University of Michigan, who is undergoing a critical edition project for George and Ira Gershwin, which really means that they're going back and studying and analyzing every Gershwin work ever created to really try to understand what was George or George and Ira's intent when they wrote the various songs and compositions, because often things get changed along the way. You don't really know what the composer or the lyricist really meant. And in George's case, because he died so suddenly and so tragically young, he never had a chance to go back and really tell people what he wanted. And so for the classical piece American in Paris, what the University of Michigan basically discovered is that the very iconic and famous taxi horns that the piece is known for is really not exactly what George had necessarily wanted. Now, knowing that George was all about the music and he believed that people should interpret his songs in a variety of ways, I don't think he'd be unhappy. But it was amazing to figure out that this iconic song, decades and decades later, potentially has been played incorrectly the whole time. And that's part of what's happening with the University of Michigan in this Gershwin Initiative, where they're trying to really get to the basis of what George and Ira intended with each song.
You also seem to have a gift for imagining what might open up the American Songbook for us. Tell us a little bit about the projects that you thought, well, this would be a good way to get this music out, not just in New York, not just in Chicago or L.A., but let's get it out across the country.
You know, I think what's interesting about the Gershwin Songbook, I think what makes it so unique, is that it spans so many different genres. So with George Gershwin, you have someone that was prolific in Broadway and musical theater, but then, you know, with Porgy and Bess has an iconic opera, but then spent so much time in the Symphony Hall with Rhapsody in Blue and American in Paris, and of course then goes to jazz. And I think as I go and try to figure out different ways to share the Gershwin Songbook with people around the world and encourage musicians to experience and record and perform the music, I try to remember that George was so diverse. And so what I try to do is figure out what are different creative ways that we can get the music out there. You know, there's certainly Broadway shows, like we have an American in Paris on Broadway right now. And then there's shows like Rhapsody in Rhythm, which is a concert that, you know, that we travel around North America and allow people to experience some of the jazz and some of the concert works that maybe you wouldn't necessarily experience that way on Broadway. But for me, it's really about, more than anything else, it's encouraging today's performers and artists and producers to play with the music, you know, not to be necessarily constrained to what they think George and Ira would have wanted, but for them to interpret the music however they would want, whether it's, like I said, American in Paris on Broadway or a recent production of Porgy and Bess, concert versions, Lady Gaga doing her song, you know, it really spans every genre as much as possible. And from, you know, elementary school children that we try to do projects with to Carnegie Hall and everything in between.
And with An American in Paris on Broadway and making such a critical splash, are there ripple effects? Have you heard from young people who have never experienced Gershwin on stage in this way? Or are there projects that you might be able to talk about?
Yeah, definitely. I think that anytime you have, you know, a notable production, like with American in Paris, which was critically acclaimed and has fortunately done well on Broadway and is now going on tour around North America and is opening in London next year, that, you know, it gets more people to be familiar with George and Ira and the specific songs that they wrote. And I think that then does have a ripple effect where we'll see symphonies performing the songs more often and companies around the country, around the world, licensing even other shows, you know, Crazy for You or My One and Only. So there definitely is a, you know, an uptick and a ripple effect, as you say, when something like An American in Paris is successful. And then, of course, you know, people want to try the next Gershwin show. And that's the nice thing about it. It does encourage people to hear the music, listen to the music, consume the music in a variety of ways.
It's so American, but not in a simplistic way, the songbook in George and Ira and their experience in the time that they lived and the music they created.
I completely agree. You know, I think that with George and Ira's music, it was really accessible. It wasn't overly complex. And people, whether it's the music or the lyrics, it's music that years and years later, people can still relate to. The lyrics are still very timely and relevant. And, you know, even classical pieces like Rhapsody in Blue, people can relate to and they can enjoy it. And it doesn't seem as, you know, necessarily obscure or complicated as maybe some other classical pieces. And I do think that it provides people an opportunity to escape. You know, there's so much going on in the world. And whether it's one song or a two-hour show, to be able to just enjoy the music is very important for people today.
Could you introduce us to Richard Glaser and his connection with the family?
Sure. So Richard Glaser is an amazingly talented musician, pianist, and storyteller. He is really one of the top Gershwin interpreters in the world right now. And his story is amazing. As a young boy, I believe he was 8 or 9 years old, he had fallen in love with Gershwin music, and he decided to write Ira Gershwin, who was living in California, a letter introducing himself. Just like any child today would, you know, reach out to a star. And Ira wrote back to him, and over the course of the next few years, as he was 8, 9, 10 years old, they were basically pen pals writing back and forth. And Ira eventually invited Richard to his home in California, where he came and he played for him and he met what he thought was one of his idols. And that really then propelled him to dedicate his life to performing Gershwin music. He's a classical pianist who has performed with symphonies, Carnegie Hall, you know, all over the world. And what makes Richard unique, in addition to being an amazing pianist, is that he also incorporates great, great stories about how the songs were written, George and Ira as brothers, as composers, as partners, and he integrates it with a multimedia component. So you have the great music accompanied by these really interesting stories that a lot of people aren't familiar with this great home videos of George and Ira, to create this really, really once-in-a-lifetime Gershwin experience that he's able to host, and he's done so really for his whole career all over the world. And he's just an amazing pianist, and as people say when they see him, he really just manages to take Gershwin music to the next level, and it's a wonderful evening. I mean, Richard, as I said, he's been in love with Gershwin music and has dedicated his whole career, his whole life to the songbook, and you can really tell that for him, it's not work when he's on stage. He really loves what he does. He's playing from the heart. He's talking from the heart. And it's really wonderful.
And Michael Andrew would not be part of that mix if he weren't something to be reckoned with as well.
Correct. Michael is the male vocalist in the concert, and he also has a wonderful history. He's a wonderful singer. He's had a really, really great career both in big band and jazz and musical theater around the world. And he just interprets the songs in a wonderful way, and I think the audiences really love him.
And just overall, as you survey and you look out at the musical world in the States, how is the American songbook doing? Are we getting bright new cabaret singers coming up, and are you encouraged?
Absolutely. There is so much incredible talent in terms of musicians, singers, spanning everything from, you know, cabaret to pops to musical theater. There's just such an abundance of great talent, which really makes it exciting, because at the end of the day, you know, George and Ira wrote these songs, and it was for other people to play and to sing and to be able to hear so many people around the world interpret these songs all the time. It's just what makes it so great, and I think that's really what would make George and Ira so happy, knowing that there's such an abundance of rich and talented performers all around the world.
And family members like you who care enough to make sure that the process is facilitated.
Yeah, you know what, we have the easy job. It's just to encourage people to play the music and to do it in their way. And the concert on Monday, August 8th, is going to be phenomenal. Of all the Gershwin concerts and shows that I've had the fortune of seeing. There's something really, really special about this one, so I really encourage people to go see Richard and Michael. They'll have a wonderful time.
Todd Gershwin of the Gershwin Family Foundation, great-nephew of George and Ira Gershwin, speaking with us in anticipation of the presentation of Rhapsody and Rhythm, the Gershwin Concert Experience, a multimedia event celebrating the music and legacy of George and Ira Gershwin, kicking off the Misericordia University Under the Stars Summer Arts Festival. It's an annual concert series on the campus in Dallas, just outside Wilkes-Barre. And the event will take place Monday, August 8th at 8 p.m. Classically trained pianist Richard Glaser and headline singer and band leader Michael Andrew will be featured. They'll present some of the most popular Gershwin songs, I Got Rhythm, It's Wonderful, They Can't Take That Away From Me, Summertime, and this work, Rhapsody in Blue. In addition to the legendary music, the concert will include rare Gershwin home videos, photos, special family stories, and more. That's Rhapsody and Rhythm, the Gershwin Concert Experience, Monday, August 8th at 8 p.m. on the campus of Misericordia University in Dallas, just outside Wilkes-Barre. For more information, on the web, misericordia.edu, misericordia.edu. MISERICORDIA, misericordia.edu.